This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. And the following is a two-part story about one young man who appears to not recognize anything as being impossible. I first met JMU student Art Peckin at one of Terry Ward's WMRA gallery opening shindigs. Art and I got to talking about his adventures. The only thing that seemed to worry Art Peckin at the ripe old age of 24 was that he'd allow himself to be seduced by comfort, either the traditional cultural comfort found in his family's close-knit Russian Baptist community, or by the professional comfort offered by Rosetta Stone, the big language learning software company that offered him the first of many jobs when Art was 17. "There's just too much going on," Art said, "to waste time being comfortable." Part one of Art's story begins when he and his family left Belarus for America in 1998. Art Peckin was 9 years old. What brought your family to America?
Well, I guess we were refugees. That was our status. And Belarus is an interesting place. I'd love to talk about Belarus.
Please do.
I spent quite some time there last year, and It's the North Korea of Europe. I guess we've had a dictator since 1994, and it's a place that still, I think, holds on to a lot of Soviet era policies. And we were refugees probably because of the history of the communism in that area and religious persecution. And when we came over, it wasn't so bad. It was getting much better. But my father's brother was in the valley, and before him, some other relative of his, and there was a church here, and
a Russian Baptist church.
A Russian Baptist church, and there was a decent community here, and I'm not sure what my parents were thinking, but probably that they could provide a better future for their children, because we were quite poor in Belarus, and we had started building a house, and we were living in this temporary little building on our land that had one bedroom. And so until I was 9 years old, I've lived in the same room with my sister and my parents. And then until I was maybe, I don't know, teenager, I had to share the room with my sister. And things have gotten much better here. And that's probably a reason why my parents decided to move their life.
What do you remember of Belarus? Was it oppressive or was it happy or somewhere in between?
There was happiness and there was oppression. My mother would tell me stories, and my grandpa, who's actually here, has told me stories of almost losing his children to the state, where he was sued by his city for, I guess, the rights to his children. They felt like he was brainwashing his children with religion, and so they wanted to take away all of his children. And let me think. I believe it's five kids, so my aunts and uncles. And my mother had some trouble in school because my grandparents wouldn't allow her to join the youth movement. I forget what they would be called. They'd wear these little red bandanas and things. And so I've also encountered a little bit of that. My teacher would make fun of me a little bit for being the only, like, the Baptist kid in the class. And I thought it was natural. I grew up with it, and I thought that's just the way things were. If you were religious, then life was just a little bit harder. And so I have good memories of Belarus. I remember a lot, and growing up in the summers at my grandparents' farm, and it was really small because everybody shared everything, and I guess very much like the communist days, even though it was all over when I was growing up.
You came here, and you sort of settled in. Did you like it?
I didn't like it at first. Everything was new, and I didn't speak the language. I knew two words.
What were they?
Kick and, or actually, no, I didn't know the word kick. I knew two words. Football, well, I guess foot and ball. And together they made another word, football.
As in soccer?
Yeah, soccer. Okay. And I think later I learned kick, and I went to Spotswood Elementary. And
not speaking English?
Not speaking English, yeah, the fourth grade. So I was in an ESL class with maybe five or six people. And it's funny that the ESL teacher was Russian. So I wasn't learning much English. in that class, I was definitely learning English by reading. And so I started with children's books and The Boxcar Children and all these books that I would probably never pick up now if I saw them, but because I've read them, I have good memories of that. And there was an accelerated reading program at Spotswood, and I got second place, I think, in the fifth grade in the number of books that I read. And I could spell very well, but I didn't really speak that much yet.
Do you have friends?
I think I was a nice kid and people liked me, and I don't think I made really close friendships throughout all of public education. I blame it on the culture I come from. And
which is?
The Russian Baptist upbringing.
How's that?
The structure that the church and family, it's very rigid. And all these things, I think, shape children into maybe being a little bit like me, a little reserved or shy at first. But I've definitely opened up, and the person I am now is, you're talking to a different person.
When did you become fluent in English?
I think 6th to 7th grade.
Okay.
Well, I could say that I was fluent in the 6th grade. I just spoke with an accent.
And you went to work at Rosetta Stone when you were 17. Had you graduated?
No, I haven't graduated yet. It was my senior year, and halfway through the year, I got a full-time job at Rosetta Stone as an IT technician.
And how did this come about?
I had an internship right before that, so I guess the beginning of the senior year. And I wasn't spending much time at Harrisonburg High School because I was at Blue Ridge. I was dual enrolling in English and some business classes, and I had gotten all my requirements taken care of, so I didn't really need to be there this senior year.
For high school?
For high school.
So you could handle a full-time job.
Yeah, and I like that about the city schools. So my senior year, I was dual enrolling in Blue Ridge, and I had an internship at Rosetta Stone where I would come in after class, open up some computers, set them up, tag them, kind of maybe enter them into the database, and that's it. And eventually I started troubleshooting a little bit, and people got to know me, and I got an offer for a job. And
so you didn't apply. They offered.
That's how I remember it. Maybe mistaken, but... And that's the way it has been at Rosetta Stone. I've gotten a lot of offers, less of me applying. I think people could see in me a shy person that wanted to do more, and that's why they offered, because they could see that I would step up to the job, and I didn't. Yeah, I did get a lot of offers. Since getting a job in high school, I focused on Rosetta Stone and kind of put college on the side. And so I went to Blue Ridge, and it probably took me 4 years to get an associate's degree. I was working full time and enjoying it. Since I've been there a quarter of my life almost, I like the company. It definitely feels like home.
What are you doing now? What's the latest offer?
So I worked a little bit as a computer technician, and it was a lot of fun. And I was willing to get up from my computer and walk down to the person with the problem instead of phoning them. And I enjoyed it. And that's how I got to know a lot of departments in the company and made some friendships. And the photography department has always interested me. And I couldn't get there because I didn't have much experience. But I got an offer from content development, and they were offering a part-time job, and I would step down and lose benefits. But it was an experimental team that I would be a team lead for, because software has gotten so complicated that they needed experts to manage our own software and try to make things more efficient. So I became content technologist, and my team grew to 11 people at one point, and I spent 2 years working on this team. And basically what I did was think the whole time, and sometimes with my feet on the table, and sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night or in the morning with a solution to the problem at work. And we were building tools that made everybody else's jobs easier on the floor. We were very popular because we were the heroes, because we just fixed everything. And 2 years of that was really fun. But at some point, I think I became overwhelmed because I was waking up in the middle of the night and it was always on my mind. And I think at that point, my photography as a hobby has developed some, and I started looking at the photo team, and secretly talking to the manager, Jeff James, and they had an opening. And I think that's the only one really I went after, is the photo team, out of all the jobs and titles and positions at the company.
So how is it to work with Art Peckin? Photography supervisor Jeff James at Rosetta Stone sent me the following note. I'd like someday to work with Artem on a creative project that has no deadline. Art is brilliant and one of the most diversely talented people I've ever met. If asked a how-to question, you can see his mind working as he translates the question from English to Russian and back again. Then he runs every conceivable process in his head, evaluates them all for efficiency and creative output, and finally responds in a way that is pure genius and the opposite of what I would have thought to do. As his manager for many years, I lost my patience more times than I'm proud of because I needed an answer right away and didn't have time or patience to wait for the more thoughtful and logical solutions he would have given me. And I could always count on him to come by my desk a day later after I spent hours slogging through the inefficient process and inform me that I could have completed the task in minutes had I waited for his answer.
So at Rosetta Stone, I was becoming too comfortable, and I felt like something needed to change. 5 years had gone by, working for the company, and things were great, but I felt like life wasn't about work, or money, or the American dream, necessarily. I think life is about, I don't know, searching for something, almost. And I had stopped searching, and I was just comfortable. So I wanted to go to school, and I wanted to leave work and just focus on my studies. And I applied to a scholarship, the Centennial Scholars Program at JMU. I think it's meant for minorities and underrepresented groups. And I felt like, being a kid from Belarus, I was definitely underrepresented. And I, at the same time, a friend of mine introduced me to a girl from Cape Town. And this friend of mine, the year before, had sold everything he had and moved to South Africa to volunteer with an organization, a nonprofit. He said that he had lots of friends and that I should take a trip down for a month. And here's this other student at JMU who I'm friends with that is going to go back for the summer. And I thought, why not? I could take a month before starting school and going to South Africa and volunteering with some organizations. And before this, I have gone to Ukraine on a few mission trips and worked with orphans. So orphans and that part of the world has a special place in my heart. And everything was kind of pointing to South Africa. I had friends to go with. I had friends that would give me connections and places to stay. I had some savings. And at one point, I was telling my parents that I wanted to go to South Africa. I wanted to quit work. I wanted to just go to college. And they weren't taking me seriously. They thought maybe I was joking or something. And I had brought it up a couple of times. And at one point, I sat down. I said, I'm buying the ticket right now. And they kind of looked at me and they said, wait, let's talk about this. And I said, no, it's too late. I've already decided we've had an opportunity to discuss this.
Back after a break to talk with Art Peckin about his travels. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff, and we're on to part two of my conversation with 24-year-old Art Peckin, a young man who's delightfully uncowed by the unfamiliar. As we heard before the break, Art's family came to America from Belarus when he was 9, and Art now periodically worries about getting too comfortable, either among his family's conservative Russian Baptist community or within the enjoyable corporate confines of Rosetta Stone, where he's been working since his senior year in high school. About a year ago, in another effort to avoid the stultifying effects of comfort, Art Peckin first applied for a scholarship to JMU and then took off for South Africa. Very little money and vague plans to rendezvous with a friend from JMU and do volunteer work with orphans.
king of the road.
I put in my resignation to Rosetta Stone, and kind of, I think, under the terms that I might be back, I had a return flight a month later, and I had like 14 weddings that summer. So I thought, okay, I'll be back in time for the first wedding a month later. And I quit work and I flew to South Africa. And the way it was set up was I went alone, and my friend from JMU was going to show up later, and I was going to stay with her family. And then once she arrived, she would connect me with an organization that I could volunteer with.
An orphanage?
Possibly an orphanage or some youth program.
Just a program in which you could do some good.
Yeah, just volunteering and I guess any kind of skills that I had that I could offer, photography or just, you know, being a human.
Yeah, that is a skill.
And I got there and very soon found out that she couldn't come. There was some visa trouble. And that turned everything upside down, a lot of drama. And fortunately, I had the contacts that my friend gave me to reach out to a Nazarene church in Cape Town. And that's the same kind of church that I'm part of here, Harrisonburg First Church of the Nazarene. And as soon as I called them and I said, "Do you know Marcus O'Malley?" They said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm a friend of his." And they said, "We'll pick you up. Where are you?" And from there, it was just amazing.
The world is a welcoming place.
The world is a welcoming place. And Marcus is a person that I think became a celebrity in Cape Town with whoever met him, because he was just open and loving, and he was there to help. And obviously, he sold everything here to move there. And he spent over a year there working with the youth and made lots of friendships. And so when I mentioned his name, all of a sudden I had all these friends and things to do and places to go. And a month flew by and I got word back from America that I didn't get my scholarship. So no JMU scholarship, no money to cover tuition and living and not working and being in college. And so I decided, I don't know, that just doesn't sound very good right now. I'll stay in Cape Town. And of course, I had all these friends and the weddings. And I thought, maybe they'll forgive me, because actually, they won't even notice that I'm not there. But it's funny, when I arrived in Cape Town, they said, "Where's your return flight? You have to show us the ticket. You can't come in." And luckily, I had bought a return flight, even though eventually I had let that ticket go. But I did have a return flight, and so they did allow me into the country, and I had a 9-month visa. And so 2 months went by. There's a woman that I lived with. Her name was Ursula, and Marcus lived with her, and she is a driver for, I guess, a taxi driver for a company. But on her free time, what she does is takes the youth from her church and, using her little van, drives them out to I guess the informal settlements and maybe places where the homeless people are, and gets the youth involved in some kind of, I don't know, projects like feeding the homeless. We would make little sandwiches and things like that, or just playing with the kids in a daycare. And there was one daycare called Sweet Things Daycare that she really loved. And so I went there often by myself on a train, which is a different story and very dangerous. I often had people on the train ask me if I was lost and what I was doing there, because I was in a neighborhood where I was the only white face around, and even in the middle of the day was a dangerous thing to do.
Just because you were white?
Yeah, just because I looked like I wasn't from the area. I looked like I was a foreigner, and so
You weren't trustworthy, or...
Well, it was...
Or it was just really a bad neighborhood.
No, people were concerned for my safety because I could be mugged, and because I looked like a foreigner, and so I probably looked like I had something on me that could be taken. But nothing ever happened in the 2 months that I was there. I was
taking the train to Sweet Things Daycare.
Yeah, and it horrified the owners of the daycare that I was taking the train. They would meet me sometimes at the train station and walk back with me, because even though it was the middle of the day and just a field that I was walking through, they were still very concerned for my safety. And I walked everywhere with a sense of, I don't know, purpose, and I was confident, and I think it showed on my face, and I think maybe that's why nobody tried to attack me.
King of the road.
2 months went by, and I had a cousin in Belarus that was also getting married, and I found out the date of his wedding. And my parents, the whole time I was in Cape Town, would write to me and we'd talk on Skype and they would say, okay, are you finished with that place? Are you ready to come home? It's unsafe. And and I said, well, I could go to Belarus. And so then as soon as they heard that, they said, yes, just go, just leave.
They wanted you out of Cape Town.
They wanted me out of Cape Town. They wanted me out of the murder capital of the world.
Yes.
And I guess I thought, Cape Town is this wonderful place and there's so much that I can plug into, but I kind of came unprepared. I've spent some time here, I've volunteered, but I'm definitely coming back with a more serious purpose and an organized project instead of just being there and plugging into whatever was around me. And I was busy the whole time. I only got to take a hike up the mountain the last day I was there. So at that point, I decided, okay, Cape Town, I'll be back. And for now, I'll move on to the next thing. And so I went to Belarus and in time for my cousin's wedding.
May I ask, were you still living on savings?
Yes, I was living on savings. And the people I was living with didn't charge me anything. And I would just buy food and I'd pay for transportation. And that was pretty inexpensive. And actually, all of my 10 months of travel, I rarely had to pay for a place to sleep. And I just paid for food and transportation. And I think with flights and everything, it was almost a year living on $5,000. It's kind of amazing.
And traveling the world.
And traveling the world, yeah, from Cape Town to Finland.
It's a big, wide, wonderful world you live in.
So I arrived in Belarus, and at that point I had really long hair and a beard, and my aunt didn't recognize me, and so first thing I did was get a haircut. Then the next day was the wedding, and Belarus, I spent all the summer there, and it was a lot of fun because I remembered everything from my childhood days. I was living in the same neighborhood. I was walking the same streets and climbing the same apple trees and riding a bicycle everywhere.
Did it seem like home?
It seemed like home, and it's still the same oppressive place that it was. The president hasn't changed since 94, and I think there's violent suppression of, like, political activists. The elections are unfair, and the economy seems to be unstable, because when I arrived, I saw that in the banks, my dollar would get me 3,500 rubles. But then, by the end of the summer, I was trading up to 10,000 rubles for that dollar.
A lot of inflation we got going there.
And it's kind of going up and down, and people every day were just trading dollars for rubles. And it was illegal because that's just all done on the black market, I guess. And they have undercover police that will arrest you if you do that. So I actually had other people that I trusted that did this for me. But it was pretty inexpensive. The American dollar got me very far. I could treat my friends to a trip to the restaurant or, like, buying pizza and
fun.
And ice cream, and ice cream is like 20 cents for like the best Soviet ice cream. So I spent, I don't know, August to November in Belarus. But at the same time, I was traveling to Russia and Ukraine. There was a time where I volunteered at a 2 weeks at a youth camp in the woods in Belarus. And it was with a church. And at the very last day, I saw a friend from America just kind of walking among some people. And I said, hey, what are you doing here? You're from Chicago. And he said, well, I'm working with orphans in Russia, and I'm leaving tomorrow, and you're coming with me. And I said, what? He said, think about it. Why not? And so in the morning, I called him, and I said, I meditated on this, and I think it's true. Why not go, besides the reason to be lazy or uncomfortable? And so next day, we get into a van, and we drive to the border of Russia, then we switch vans because they have different plates, and we transfer everything, and it's all done at night, and it's kind of shady. Nobody checks my passport. I don't know if we're crossing the border legally or not. And the next day, we were in Ostrov in Russia. And
let me stop you for a minute. Did any part of you worry about this, that, you know, you could be arrested or get in real trouble? Or did you just feel that it was like you did when you were walking across those fields in South Africa, that everything was going to be okay?
Yeah, I felt safe.
Good for you.
I felt like, I guess, I was under protection of a higher power, and it gave me confidence, and I walked everywhere with a purpose. And so driving to Russia at night, a very uncomfortable trip. I think it might have been an 18-hour drive from Brest. By the way, I'm from Brest, Belarus, and it's a city of over 300,000 people on the border of Poland in the west and Ukraine in the south. And so it's a very good place to live because you can work and there's trade that happens across the borders. And so people are better off in that city, in that area, than the rest of Belarus. So driving from Brest to Ostrov, I think it took about 18 hours. And when we got there, it turns out that my friend, Roman, had tricked a lot of others into coming and helping him. And with his personality, he's an organizer. He's a businessman. And so he needed help with his mission to set up these almost like camps for the children.
For orphans. Yeah.
And so he needed people. And so there were, I think, 6 people there that were from America that were just in the area. And then a lot of locals. And so what we would do is every day at 6 in the morning, we'd get into the vans, gather a bunch of toys and sports equipment, and we'd drive to an orphanage. We would prepare some kind of program for the kids. We would have a lot of fun with them. Then some kind of, I guess, a person from the church would give a message and invite the kids to the church. And then we would continue playing with the kids. But really the mission was to show these children some love and some hope, and to have that, make that connection. And sometimes we would visit 3 orphanages in a day with an hour or 2 drive in between. And there were days where we didn't eat the whole day. We forgot that we haven't had a meal. And so at midnight, when we returned, we might go to a sauna, because that's the Russian thing to do, is sauna is a good thing. And we would eat in the sauna and then pass out, and then a couple hours later wake up and repeat the whole thing again. And we were sleeping in an office building with no bathrooms, just one empty room on the floor, and the outdoors were your bathroom and your shower, and we'd go to the gas station if you needed something else. And that was about 2 weeks with my friend Roman in this place in Russia, and it's a couple hours south of St. Petersburg, Ostrov. And towards the end of my stay, I was beginning to worry, how am I going to get back? I took a one-way trip to Russia with this guy. And
sort of quasi-legal.
Well, it was legal because I'm a citizen of Belarus, and okay, I'm allowed in Russia, and I'm a dual citizen with the United States. So crossing borders for me is pretty easy. I do worry sometimes that the Belarusians will arrest me for, I don't know, having a second passport, because their relationship with the United States isn't the best.
It's problematic, yes.
Yeah.
But you're wondering about how you're going to get back to Belarus.
Yeah, I was wondering, how am I going to get back to all of my stuff, because I had packed lightly. And so here I am, a couple hours south of St. Petersburg, and 2 weeks went by, and we had this amazing time where we visited lots of orphanages, and we've made some friendships and shared some love with these orphans. And there's a place we visited near the Latvian, I think, border that houses all the children from Russia that have the worst disorders, I guess genetic mutations and things. And so there are some very, very scary things that I saw, and it was a very touching moment to get a smile from a child that was severely disabled. I mean, children that, for example, can't move because their joints are, I guess they've, I don't know any of the names for these disorders, but I guess all the worst cases are sent to this one place. And so from there, having had that experience, I wondered how I'd get back. And my friend suggested, well, you could take a train from St. Petersburg to Brest, because Brest is actually on a rail line from Berlin to Moscow. And so it's got great infrastructure in terms of transportation. So I decided to drive up to St. Petersburg and take a train down. And that was, I think, a 16-hour train from St. Petersburg down to Brest. And I had gone with a few friends up to St. Petersburg. We spent some time walking in the city and a couple of days just getting to know the city and climbing some rooftops and, I guess, doing some illegal things. And by the way, that's something about me, is I like to challenge maybe my upbringing and the things that seem normal and not normal. So if it's not okay to climb a rooftop, I'll probably do it.
Done laid around, done stayed around this old town too long. Summer's almost gone, winter's coming on. Done laid around, done stayed around this old town too long. And and it seems like I've got to travel on.
You'll find a photo of Art Peckin taken during his holiday visit to Moscow on the Spark page at WMRA.org, where you'll also find some of Art's travel photographs taken from rooftops and other creative and artistic perches.
And it seems like I want to travel on.
Back after a break with retired concert violinist Daniel Heifetz, founder of the Heifetz International Music Institute, which recently relocated to Mary Baldwin College.